to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
You're drowning and I throw you a life jacket. Would you grab it? Yes, good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns.
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know this.
That's it. I'm done.
Hello, welcome back to Stockton Jackson. There's like my mic anywhere near me here, man. For God's sake. Cleaning lady was here and she tied my mic cord in a knot, for God's sake. This is bull. SP Futures down 975. NASDAQ Futures
sounded like a struggle.
Yeah, it was like, I'd be into, what is it, bondage? Can you do that to yourself with your mic cord? Jeez.
Sure you can in the closet, but guys die from it all the time.
There's a thing for that.
That's right.
Should we go into that or not?
I think David Carradine died that way, among others.
Yes. Did you ever read any of the Eric Lustbatter novels?
No.
Ninja, White Ninja. He actually took over the Robert Ludlum's name and wrote like some Robert Ludlum stuff after Robert Ludlum died. I mean, the family, he continued to write under the Ludlum name, even though his Lustbatter was writing, so they must have got some money for that. But it was some of the real some of that stuff is very interesting because you get a little bit of an influx into the Asian mind that like everything has a name and everything is very orderly, unlike us. Whatever you do in any kind of even the martial arts, everything has a name, everything has a discipline, everything has. There's a whole, and there's disciplines and sub-disciplines and, like sumos. I mean, to you and I, it might just look like a couple of fat guys running into each other, right? But that's not true. It's like, there's like 100 and, I know I'm off by a couple, there's like 101 sumo moves. Not 100, not 102, not 103, but 101. And you have to be a master of all of them to be a sumo master. And you and I couldn't pick one of those out if our life depended on it, but evidently, they're all different.
And, yeah. Well, not only that, even their diet, you know, you would think, oh, they're just eating everything to get huge, but they actually have a very specific diet to get to the exact weight that they're trying to get to.
And they can suck their male parts back up into their body so they don't get whacked there. How the hell do you do
that? That's a talent.
Sometimes you'd like to do that if you're a catcher, I think.
Sure.
Anywho, but where was I going with this? But everything has a name, Manny. So that's just where all that is. SP Futures down 10, Dow Futures down 81, NASDAQ Futures down 41. The big move over the weekend, even though it's come back some, the Bitcoin was down at some point this weekend, like 5,000 or something. Well, now they're showing up 1,000 as of today. So I think this, what are the trades all weekend, right? Wherever it trades. And it got up to, what, 66, so it's down to 56, up 1,000. So it was down 10,000 bucks from high to low there at some point. It's interesting. Now we have these earnings coming out, and it's some of your companies have come back to, will Coca-Cola earnings beat? The company says the demand in March returned to pre-pandemic levels. I have the stock up 42 cents at 54.10 this morning. Individual stocks in the Dow, nothing going crazy. Amgen's down a buck and a half. We got Goldman Sachs down a buck 80. Then a lot of stuff came out this weekend, Matty. Well, a lot of interesting stuff in the city. A lot of sports we have to talk about. And also, they're floating this thing. What are they going to do with these student loans? And, you know, it's, you and I have been talking. We've been doing a little bit more of it ourselves lately, which is, I think, good in some ways. What do you do when you just see, and again, I'm gonna, without being political about this, when you see people looking at like a wealth tax and you look at people looking at different stuff, you know, estate taxes, you look at those kinds of things and some of it, first of all, for an economic perspective, if you assume things are fair all along the way, I don't like any of that stuff. I don't know what your opinions are, but I think the idea of getting somebody to pay twice, if somebody goes to work, pays all his taxes, and then he croaks and you steal more money from him, why? He already paid. I mean, but I think a lot of people, and rightfully so, at least in some cases, think that a lot of people never pay. And the system works for them. And at the end of the day, you need to do something specific for that. Matter of fact, did you ever hear of something we haven't heard? We have not used this term, Maddie, I'm going to say, in 3 years. The alternative minimum tax, remember that?
Yeah, actually.
When was the last time you heard anybody mention it?
It's been, you're probably right, 3 to 5 years ago.
Yeah. And there is a tax, called an alternative minimum tax, and it was people who had a lot of, was depreciation, was capital gains, but I never had to pay it, so I don't, I guess I should know more about it than I do, but it had to do with all the tax preference items. It might be depreciation, it might be, definitely was capital gains, and there was other stuff that, at the end of the day, if you took advantage of all that stuff, you still had to pay some sort of a tax. You had to pay something.
And so, they have like a floor.
Yeah. And I think, maybe, why don't you Google a thing? I'm going to say that the year that the tax came out, it has to be, I'm going to say somewhere in the 50s. I'm going to say it affected something like 24 taxpayers. It was under 100. Just the people that were just absolute Houdinis at using all these tax preference items. I won't say dodges because they weren't. They were in the code. And
started in 1969.
All right. That was a little before.
It says, in 1969, Congress noticed that 155 people with high incomes were legally using so many deductions and other tax breaks that they were paying absolutely nothing in federal income taxes.
All right. So 155 for an entire country.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it got to the point where, anybody making $80,000, $90,000 a year would, you and your lovely bride, you had to worry about this thing. Because if you had any kind of capital gains or anything, or deductions for kids or whatever, if you don't have any kids yet, whatever it was, you had to add up all kind of your preferences. And when people, it's stunning, maybe we talk about, I think, a lot, at what people don't think about. And I think it's the one thing maybe people get from the show, is that people talk about when Ronald Reagan was president, the Dutch. He's everybody's god, right? Well, first of all, his tax decrease, they had a tax increase like a year later because it was so bad in terms of the federal deficit. But also, we had something called bracket creep. You ever hear that term?
I've heard you mention it. I assume it means, bleeding into different tax brackets?
Well, yeah, they used to be. Now there's only, three or four tax brackets. Well, I haven't done any taxes in so long. But there's not very many. There used to be all kinds of tax brackets. Like, if you made 12 grand, your tax was X plus 12% of everything you made between 12 grand and, 13.5 or 14 or something. Then if you made 14, it was X plus, maybe 1% more of everything you made between 14 and 15.5. So what happened was, we have talked a lot about inflation and cost of living increases in people's salaries. The problem was with that is all this stuff, isn't it funny, Manny, that all this stuff that I talk about and other members of the show talk about, all this stuff seems to benefit the government. to the detriment of the, I'm going to say, not ignorant as an individual. No individual is ignorant, but the collective ignorance of the population. That if you started out, say in 1971, 72, when maybe you first got your cost of living increase, well, in the next 6 or 7 years. Call it 8 years, the person who was making 20 grand a year, if he had cost of living, he could now be making, pushing 40,000 a year, 38, say, somewhere in there. And his, it didn't do him any good because the inflation had doubled in the meantime, right, or came close to it. However, his tax rate at the 20 grand number might have been 10%, and at the 38 grand number is more like, might have been 20% or 25. So that was the bracket creep, that his percentage he started paying to the Fed. Now, along the way, they pulled some of these down because people pissed at him, right, and recognized it. So some of those brackets came down. I mean, if you look at what people actually paid in those days in some of those brackets, I mean, nobody making 20 grand now pays like 15% in taxes, income taxes, right? But then again, 20 grand then but now it's all made up in your payroll taxes, and it's made up in your state taxes. Because now your payroll taxes are what, 15% right out of the gate?
But actually, don't know.
I think your Social Security, your Medicare, unemployment. I think it's 15%. Because that's what if you lob a 1099 at somebody who like cut your lawn or something, I think their number is like 15%. We'll have to get a tax guy in there one of these days to go over these numbers for us. But what I'm saying is what happens now is you're seeing people. This is not new, where people look at people that just, I don't care how you did it, but the fact is you didn't pay anything. We got to find a way for you to pay something. This is not new. So what you're seeing now with this wealth tax and with this other stuff, you look at the Bezoses of the world and those guys, and you say, wait a minute, Amazon is paying 5%. You look like, stock's going up and you haven't sold any yet. It looks to me like you're pretty damn wealthy. I mean, you need to pay something. I mean, this is crazy. That's the mentality. Now, if it was fair, I would never agree with something like that, you know, but I don't know that it is fair. And some people always manage to dodge the bullet. Now the question is, what do you do about it? And now we're looking back at the latest thing on the Biden agenda is, what are we going to do with these student loans? And you're tighter than this than I am. If you saw the thing I sent around last night, you know, there's all kinds of plans now to do something with these student loans. Now, and there's an article here from, it's by Annie Nova. And I think we've quoted from her before. She's a good writer.
Yeah, I think so.
She writes for CNBC. We'd love to have her talk about this. Love her as a guest someday. So the numbers now are anywhere from 10,000, 50,000. What different amounts of student loan forgiveness would mean for borrowers. And quote, how do you do it? Now I would look at this, and I can see, well, I think I can see, but many people can't disagree, an awful lot of things that have happened in the last certainly 12 or 13 years that have to do with this zero interest rates that have insanely been pushed on the population by the Federal Reserve. And guess what, Matty? After 12 to 15 years, there's huge winners by this and huge losers, right? Imagine that. Anytime.
As always.
As a government policy. Whatever things are not, quote, market driven, and whatever they're not fair, you're going to have winners and losers. So you have, obviously, massive bank winners because they get people's money for free. And they've been lending out student loans at, what, 6%, 6.5%, when they're getting it for nothing. Money for nothing and your chicks for free, but your student loans are not free. And your credit cards are not free. But the credit cards, if you really get stuck, you can bail on with a bankruptcy, right? Now, you've still got it stuck where the sun don't shine. And I know some people, matter of fact, one of my buddies at the Fed, of course, we were having an adult beverage one night, and he's talking about people who, how many people have bail on their credit cards and how these poor banks get stuck from these people.
God.
Yeah. And I said, wait, whoa on that one. I said, let's put it to you this way. When you get somebody who, how many people who bail on their do bankruptcy and bail on their credit card loans, how many people have actually paid off the initial amount before you get into this? By that meaning, I don't think your lovely bride would do this because you guys are doing pretty good, but you go out and you buy some furniture, all right, and you throw it on the credit card, you got the house, you say, all right, we're going to pay this off. All of a sudden, somebody gets sick or somebody breaks a foot or somebody gets hurt someplace. All of a sudden, you get this emergency room bill, and now your credit card's higher and you can't pay it. But now it's 20-some percent, right? And oh, by the way, God help you if you miss one, if you're late one day, then it's what, 30%. And so now you've got this issue, and it piles in there, and you fight this for 3, 4, 5 years. Finally, somebody loses a job, and you say, "Hell with it, I'm bankrupt." Or you don't just say that; you got to go through the bankruptcy process. So I'm going to say, Matty, that in a lot of those cases, I happen to have a family member who's been fighting this for a real long time. Remember that guy I used to talk to on the Triple A all the time, an attorney? Well, he died. It was a little guy, he used to be across the street, and anyway, he had student loan debt, and he had credit card debt, and all he was doing his entire life was paying his stuff off. And he couldn't get hired by a firm because they checked his credit rating. Then they'd hire him at like $35 an hour and bill him out at $200. You know that kind of credit. They'd do him a favor at $35 and bill him out at $200 or $300. Anyway, he could never get ahead because he was talking about 30% interest on this stuff. But I'm going to bet you that by the time the guy croaked, that he had paid off 2 and 3 times his original whatever the hell he bought, furniture, God knows what. So when you're talking about not paying the interest, I don't know that you're actually screwing the bank all that much. It's like some of the losers that were the Bernie Madoff people, and again, Bernie cost people an awful lot of money, so I'm not. But how many people, Matty, have you heard of that gave Bernie $500,000? Bernie told them they had $3 million at one point, which they never did. And when it went back down to $500,000, they're convinced they lost $2.5 million.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah,
of course.
Come on. I mean, let's.
I remember being with you at Sirius and talking to somebody who had lost their ass from Madoff, and of course they were talking about, you know, what they lost on the balance sheet that wasn't real.
Yeah,
right in front of us.
Yeah,
and you probably know who I'm talking about.
Oh yeah,
and I'm like thinking to myself. I mean, of course I didn't say anything because you know I don't.
But you had picked up the math.
But I picked up the math. Yeah. I'm like, now you may have still given them a lot of money, and you still may have lost a lot of money. I'm not saying you didn't, but this idea that you lost the fake number on the balance sheet, that's hilarious.
But you know what? A lot of people think that way. What are you talking about? I got this statement said I had $3 million. Now I got one. I'm down two, but you only gave them one. it's great. But so I said this to my buddy the Fez. How many people actually, the original amount, how many of the things the banks were actually down? And he goes, well, that's a whole different number. I go, yeah. I mean, 25% plus any kind of fees for, I mean, this builds up.
I don't think they're ever down.
No. Well, you could be. I mean,
I think they have so many sort of, I don't know if you would call it insurance or what, that covers them for anything like that. I don't think they're ever down.
I think they can, if somebody goes in and has some kind of a medical issue, puts it on a credit card in the emergency room, and then maybe has a real medical issue and like dies, they're not getting that money.
Well, that's probably true.
I mean, there's stuff they're not getting. I mean, because most people, I've read, you know, not recently, so I can't really lob out the number that I remembered. It's some over 50% of your credit card bankruptcies have to do with an unexpected expense that nobody. I mean, people don't get a credit card for 24% and say, "Whoopee, I'm going to start paying 24%." Your first thought in your mind is, "I'm never going to carry a balance," right?
Ideally, yeah.
And then all of a sudden, one day, a lot of the balances that cause people to declare bankruptcy have to do with medical stuff, trip to the emergency room, something like that. And you know, and you just can't come back from that. It's just anyway, the student loan debt. But now all of a sudden, you've got an issue, and I think I've had an issue now for many. We were doing the show. Let me take this up here. It was not. It'll take me a second before I get my debtclock.org up here. I'm going to say we had been doing a show for a few years, and pulled out your student loan debt used to be part of just regular debt, right? And then they separated them.
Okay.
It used to be part of now student loan debt It's different than credit card debt. And you and I remember the day, and I bet we could go back, you could, not me, the archives, there was a day when student loan debt passed up credit card debt. I remember we talked about it, because when they first split them out, it was, the student loan debt was lower than credit card debt, but it had been growing. Well, now it's $1.7 trillion on the student loan piece, and let's call it $1 trillion on the credit card debt. So now it's pushing doubling. Not quite doubling, but it's 80% higher. So, and this is, let me find out what the student loan debt goes. I can find out when this. But now they're saying, after a long period of time, these people shouldn't have been paying 6.5%, right? I mean, why should you? I mean, really. And so, let's see if we can go back just a few years. So now the question is, how do we trim it down? Now, of course, you've got people who will say, well, geez, let's just you see, even if you go back to 2016, the consumer debt is lumped together at $3.6 trillion. And the credit card debt's about the same number as it is now, by the way. But they did not split out student loan debt in 2016. So it must have happened like 4 years ago, somewhere in that area. Anyway, so now the question is, I mean, you and I might say, do we want to make this fair? How can we make this fair? Now, you and I may want to make it fair. Do you think anybody else really wants to make it fair? The answer is probably no. Not saying they're crooks or anything. Just saying. But if you take, and this, there's some spectacular numbers in here. Here's a lady, Phyllis Winter, has student loan debt for 30 years. She's 67. She still owns $48,000.
Yikes.
Yeah. And now
what the hell'd she do?
She probably co-signed grandkid or something, okay. I guess. She owes $48,000. The odds of student, they're going to do some, there's a number in here about people. Growing number, one-third of student loan borrowers over the age of 65 are in default. And half of those over 75 have fallen behind. So they must be helping out kids. I mean, it can't be them. So cancel. Now here's the numbers. If you cancel student loan debt for people over the age of 65, you'd cost the government around $59 billion, and you impact 2 million people. So wherever you put the number here, if you do it by age, by profession, or by number, this article is actually, well, like I said, we should tweet this out.
I already did. Yeah, but you can find it on our Twitter at Stocks and Jobs.
But it tells you what happens if you forgive $10,000, what happens if you give $50,000, and you do it by age. So there's no way I can encapsulate this whole thing just by on the air here. But anyway, the steady climb was $500 billion in 2006, and now it's $1.7 trillion, 14 years later. So it's tripled in essentially 14 years, and it really affects people of all walks of life. I mean, the 2/3 of student loan borrowers in the U.S. earn under $100,000 a year. It would cost the government around $938 billion to erase the loans for everyone under that threshold. So the poor bastard who makes 101, he's screwed, right? Now, see, anytime you do something like this, it just bothers the hell out of me. Then you're talking about how many by race, black or African American, 49%, borrow 38% white, 29% Latino, and only 21% Asian. So, anyway, so why don't we just, is it possible to just do something fair and just say, okay, everybody's paid on average, what do you think, Manny, 5%? You get a blended rate between the private, which is what, somewhere in the sixes, and the government, which is in the threes. So where does that put you? High fours? Five?
Sounds right.
Why don't we just say, look, everybody's paid too much at the 6.5 number, especially the last 12 years. God's sake, the rates for your savings have been zero. You know, I mean, what are we doing here? Why don't we just rebate everybody 1-2% of the interest? Even if you've already paid it off, you get a check. Somebody like you. Well, I mean, why not just make it fair? Without saying, oh, if you're under this amount, you get it, or if you're this old, you get it, or this amount. Why don't we just have a rebate back, if we're going to do one, if we think we screwed everybody, why can't we just do something like that, where it's somewhat fair?
That would be more fair to everyone, certainly. But there is this idea of wealth redistribution that's sort of a hot topic right now, not just with student loans, but just in general, where they believe that people over a certain threshold, I don't think it's 100,000, but call it 500,000 or whatever, have certainly over the last 2 years really taken even a bigger share of the pie from everyone below that threshold. And I think this is yet another way that they're trying to sort of rebalance things slightly.
Well, some have, some haven't. But Amazon clearly has. The guy who owned the clothing store surely has, and he's been shut down.
Yeah.
I mean, it's never even.
Well, it's never perfectly even, of course. It's impossible to be perfectly even. But there's no doubt that there's been a wealth redistribution problem in this country that's been happening for, I don't know, 50 years, and it's really accelerated in the last several years.
I don't disagree with you at all, by the way. But I think if you were to apply some very rigorous economic... You have to have your wife do this. I don't think you're much rigorous on these things.
I'm not rigorous about anything.
No, that's what I'm saying. You're rigorous about taking the garbage out when she tells you.
That's right. Well, I don't want to pile it up. She's not taking it down, so I have a choice to make.
Do you think there's ever going to be an automatic garbage taker out, or is that always going to be the guy?
I'm waiting for the Jetsons robot to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So, but I mean, why can't we, the person who got a raise, like suppose, you know, you get a big raise at your place, you're not all of a sudden taking advantage of other people. You're not the person who went from $1 billion last year to 10 this year. I mean,
no, I'm not.
I mean, just to say that the person who made 400,000 versus the person who made 200,000 somehow is gaming the system and screwing everybody is totally wrong, I think.
100% agree, but no matter where you draw the line, you have to draw the line somewhere.
I think so, you should draw the line where the people are cheating.
Well, I totally agree there.
SP Futures down 11, NASDAQ Futures down 45. Come back from break, we'll add Mr. Flanagan to this conversation.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Harrell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, Give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen. I'm just Brent Weber on the board with Mr. Jim Flanagan here in a second. S&P futures down 1075. Nasdaq futures down 40. A little bit of a dip here. After last week being a strong week, Dow futures down 80. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 5, call that flat. These guys have been relatively quiet lately. I mean, there's not much volatility. FTSE up 18.2%, CAC around 27.4. In Asia, we got the Nikkei up 2, call that flat. Shanghai up 50.1%. We've got the Hang Seng up 136, that's 0.5%. So again, these guys over in Asia have been all over the block. This is a review. Friday, Dow was up 164, S&P's up 15, NASDAQ up 13. Bonds, 1.57, it's unchanged. Bund, minus 0.24. The Bund is creeping back towards zero. We'll see if they make it this time. A little ways to go, but certainly a lot closer than the 0.37 negative was last week. Japan actually heading back towards zero at 0.08. We've got oil down 17 cents, but 62.96. Paid 301 for gas, man. It was not happy in the threes and the burbs. Because literally $4 by us, right? Brent down 18 cents, 66.59. Natural gas up 4 cents, 272. RBOB unchanged at 203. We've got gold up 460, 1784. That's a 7-week high and a weak dollar, lower yields. Silver up 5 cents. Copper up 9 cents, 426. That's got to be a recent record in copper. Or darn close. And we've got crypto going the other way. Well, Bitcoin's up 1,200, but it was down like 4,000 or 5,000 on Saturday or Sunday. So that's where that is. Manny, what do you got for us? Travel Weather Sports.
36 minutes past the hour. Good morning to everyone out there. Off to a pretty good start on the area expressways, roadways, and tollways. We have one issue to report, and that's down south. Bishop Ford on the outbound side at 159th Street. There's a crash blocking the right lane. A car is in the ditch. And crews are on the scene, and that right lane is blocked due to that crash on the outbound Ford, so keep that in mind. No issues on the inbound side. The Ryan and I-57 are all quiet. Same for the Stevenson. No issues on the Eisenhower. Edens and Kennedy looking good. Lakeshore Drive is quiet in both directions, so no other crashes or significant delays to report on a early Monday morning. Weather today, we take a bit of a temperature dive beginning this afternoon. And certainly into tomorrow, but today will be a high of 50, which is kind of where we're at right now, and then we'll be colder later on. Chance of some clouds rolling in and some showers later on today as well, but a high of 50. Right now it's mostly clear and 49 degrees downtown. For our Phoenix listeners, sunshine with a high of 88 today. Right now it's clear and 61. In sports, the White Sox had a great day in Boston yesterday, sweeping a 7-inning doubleheader from the Red Sox, winning game 1 3-2 and the nightcap 5-1, as they have now won 2 in a row and are back at 500. Cubs broke out the bats on Saturday, and on Sunday it looked like they might do the same, but they couldn't pitch enough as they were blown out at home against the Braves 13-4, losing 2 out of 3 in that series. Diamondbacks beat the Nationals 5-2. So as we take our Monday morning look at the MLB standings, the White Sox are now 8-8 after winning 2 in a row yesterday. They're third place in the AL Central, 2 games back of the first place Kansas City Royals. The Cubs are in last place in the NL Central at 6-9, 3 games behind the first place Cincinnati Reds. Diamondbacks are 6-10. They're fourth in the NL West, but they're 7 games back of the Red Hot Dodgers, who are 13-3. Chief.
So how is it that somebody, John, how are you?
Pat, I'm fine. How about you?
Okay, so as a guy who somebody forgot to do something today, traditionally, the day of the Boston Marathon, which is supposed to be today, they start a baseball game very early, and it's because it's Patriot Day, right?
That's right.
Well, of course, they bleep can the marathon, but the Cubs are still in the game at 10-10, or the Sox, at 10-10 this morning.
That's right. White Sox at Red Sox at 10:10 a.m. Central Time. It's 11:10 local time, first pitch in Boston. And typically, like Chief said, that coincides with the Boston Marathon, and it's a day that everyone has off in Boston. It's a big celebratory day. And, it was tainted several years back with the Boston Marathon bombing. But marathon is canceled this year because of COVID, and they're still having the baseball game.
Actually, it's pushed off to October.
Okay, so they just delayed it. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
We keep pushing this off, this COVID thing, and then we get there, it's kind of...
Well, now I think we're to the point where the vaccinations are so prevalent that whether they want to keep it closed or not, I don't think they can anymore here in the next couple months. Otherwise, there's going to be a riot.
I think you're probably right on that. We heard from Kevin last night that the governor of Michigan now is trying to slide all these things being permanent, that people should wear masks like all the time now forever and so forth. In stores, and you.
Speaking of Kevin, he writes in, the fairest way to forgive student loans is to exchange it for service. Could be military, could be working in city schools, could be any kind of service to those who get assistance from the government. Bigger debt, work longer.
Okay. So Kevin has his point of view.
Which I actually don't disagree with. If you don't want to pay your student loan, it's so an alternative to work it off via volunteering for government services.
So what's the 67-year-old lady going to do? Give Pritzker a massage?
Well, I'm sure they could find something for her to do in a government office.
Clean?
Or in a school, or volunteer or something. I don't know. Or she could just pay it off. You have a choice.
Obviously, she can't pay it off. She's been for 30 years.
Yes. I mean, her case is not a good one.
There's a... I get a... One of my buddies... a long time ago, so we didn't really have to go nameless, except I can't remember his name anyway. He's a sailor, big time sailor, done the Mackinac stuff and everything. So he just so happens he's up at Mackinac. And, so he comes back from, let's say an adult emporium, not in the best of shape, hops on the boat, kind of trips, lands, hits his mouth on one of those nasty ass buckles. He just beats the hell out of his mouth, right? So, heads off to the clinic because he's bleeding all over the place. The guy in the clinic just happens to be a guy who's a plastic surgeon dude who says, well, I got nothing to do. I might as well fix this guy up right. And he was doing that. He was donating his time. Not donating. He was doing that in terms of the state paying off his medical school debt. So I really do think on a small level that can work out very well. So the guy...
Why not on a big level?
Because I don't think that when you're talking about a million people with debt, what are they all going to do?
I'm sure we could find stuff for people to do. Pick up trash.
I think it's more than a million people. I mean,
it could be 100 million people. I don't know what the number is. But I'm just saying there's always stuff to do, whether it's military, whether it's volunteering at schools, whether it's cleanup.
I'm not disparaging anything like that. What I'm saying is one of the issues is, people are paying 6% when they should have paid 4%. So let's at least get rid of the 2% first.
I'm cool with that.
I mean, you know, I mean, a lot of people that have student loan debt or a problem or a disability and can't discharge it through bankruptcy. What are we going to do with them? I'm saying, you know, it's not a bad idea. It's just, you know, when you every time you have one of these minimalist solutions, you have problems with it to a huge issue.
Well, but the examples you're given are still examples today that are a problem. It's not like that's a new problem.
No.
They can't pay off their loans. So if they can't do anything, they still can't. They're still in the same boat they were today. So you haven't created a new problem.
What I'm saying is the person that went in with the program in Michigan, he did community service as a doctor for a while, and he knocked those loans down, and it worked out very well for him. So, yes, Kevin's idea, if that's one of the programs you've got, is a terrific idea. But as a general solution for millions of people with debt, I don't know how it flies, is all I'm saying.
On the front, we're age restricted in some way, so where you have people who are actually in their, you know, best years who are able to perform meaningful service. So say you're under 30 or 40 or whatever, as a way of retiring some of your debt, I think it might be okay. I don't think it's too workable when you're dealing with people who are in their 60s performing some kind of service that's really meaningful, that's going to defray anybody's, perform any good service or actually, you know, equate that with any kind of debt reduction too. So I think that would have to be age-weighted in some way.
I would like to know what percentage of people that have student loan debt that they can't afford to pay are over 65. Are we talking like less than 1%?
I just had that for me.
I missed that.
I will dig it out again. Not again. I mean,
it can't be a huge number of people over 65.
Way more than you think.
That can't pay their student loan debt.
2 million people.
Yeah, but I'm talking about on a percentage basis.
Canceling student loans for people over the age of 65, I open this up just to that sentence, would cost the government $59 billion and impact 2 million people. That's a lot of people. Way more than I thought, 65.
Yeah, that is a lot of people. I think you're right that a lot of them are probably co-signed for a child or a grandchild or something. But
let's put it this way. I think, and Jim, both of you guys, I think the idea of having service work, I think it works on the front end. When I say this, if you wanted to get a MBA, Maddie, or something, and you wanted a student loan going into it, if the first year out of your MBA school you had to work, you had to donate, not donate, but you had to work for $25,000 a year for the Secretary of State's office, and they would knock off, you know, $30,000 of your debt. On the front end as a deal, I think Kevin's idea is spectacular. I don't know what you do if Maddie Weber is now 65 and disabled and hasn't paid it back. Who are you going to service?
Well, he was saying the 67-year-old can be the lunch lady at a school, can work in a school office, can serve meals at the homeless shelter, et cetera. There's probably always something you can do. But I think your point is you'd rather solve the problem by making college cheaper and,
yes,
and by reducing the loan rate,
which
I agree with 100%. And if we can do that, that's going to help a lot of people. It's still not going to allow people completely to pay it back.
Right, but the exercise here that we're having this morning with Kevin participating is a good one. I mean, I had no idea that if you tossed people over 65 that were talking $59 billion, I would never have dreamt that. And I would never have thought it was 2 million people. You know, so it's here's another, by profession. By canceling the student loans of social workers, there you go, with people that are doing something, would cost the government $18 billion and deliver relief to roughly 400,000 people. Well, the government have to shell out $117 billion. This, like I said, it's a damn good article. We'd have to, how much for teachers? I'll ask John. He was a teacher.
Yeah, I'm trying to find any plans here that talk about rebating teachers.
There you go. Well, I just happened to look
certainly at that. A teacher could work, if you're certified and able to go out and start, you know, hitting the road the first day, that could be one way of working off your student debt. But, you know, the problem with all of this, though, is that you're looking at the beast that's still breathing in the background,
right.
This isn't likely to reduce tuitions or room and board expenses or the competition among all these universities to attract people who are going to pay top dollar into their graduate programs and still have them, you know, by the throat for a long time. That is going to take a long time to get back to some kind of normal. And I don't think that giving people freebies for this is a way to do that. There's still going to be this engine that's driving the whole student loan industry. And as long as that money's available, there's going to be ways of spending it, so.
All right, well, let's use the work that this lovely lady did for us. The government would have to shell out $117 billion to forgive the debt of teachers, which would leave around 3 million people debt-free. So that's a lot. The idea of forgiving the education debt of doctors and nurses has also gained popularity among doctors and nurses, no doubt. that's the beauty of this. I think we should, if I had student debt, I think we should get rid of the student debt of money managers, right, and people who do podcasts.
That was never real impact, ever.
Yeah, but that's really what it comes down to, right?
This is just pitting the population against other segments of the population.
Yeah, I mean,
where's mine? You know,
well, that's right.
Mike Werkel motto is like everybody's going to expect something, and nobody's going to like the fact that somebody who made some other career choice that looked pretty stupid to somebody at the time, but now is going to create a windfall for you. So I don't know if that's going to go down too well with the population at large.
Anyway, doctors and nurses, doing so would cost $250 billion and likely impact a million individuals. Well, first of all, look at the numbers here. Wow. Student loans of social workers would be $18 billion, but you'd help out 400,000 people. All right. But now doctors, look at the numbers these guys must have. For a million people, it's $250 billion. So we're talking 2.5 times as many people as social workers, but it's 15 times the amount of money. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Well, and of course, what isn't really in these figures is how difficult it is even for a doctor or a brain surgeon, let alone a lawyer or some other professional, to pay off loans when your income stream is not what it should be either. I mean, most of these places are working, people are working now for entities to take a big chunk of their earning power. They're employees of some big system. It's hard for them to make ends meet. It may seem ridiculous, but I don't think a doctor's lifestyle is anything like what it used to be.
No,
to
not even close.
Population.
Well, they're nowhere near the highest paid people in a hospital.
Oh, no, exactly. Yeah.
Which is insane. By the way, we had here's one. I can use this somewhat of a politically incorrect nickname, but I won't use his name, but you know just what I'm talking about. Remember our buddy Rotund? Roro? Anyway, I ran into him at a party or golf outing a few years ago. By the way, the guy isn't even that heavy, but he was heavier than everybody else, so he was known as Rotund. Roro for 4 years in college. And
I remember.
But he was telling me some girl, he goes, this girl comes in to interview, he's in a little law firm. She goes, she's real bright, she's real attractive, she's got a great education. She went to, I don't know where else, she went to like the Michigan or someplace undergrad and then like Yale or something, grad school. And she comes in and she wants a job and we're like falling over ourselves to hire her. So finally we get her numbers. Not the numbers you're talking about, Manny. Manny's immediately. we got her numbers and she owed like 300 grand. And this is 15 years ago. He goes, we know what we could pay her. And there's no way she's paying it. I don't want her working as a waitress or a pole dancer at night. He goes, we didn't hire her. And he goes, I don't even know if that's legal. Using those numbers to make an employment decision. He goes, but so we're going to start her out at, say, 125 grand a year. There's no way she's paying that back. With the number, and we were stretching because we really wanted her. He goes, so we told her no. And she couldn't believe we told her no. We didn't tell her. It's because we didn't want you to be a pole dancer Saturday nights. I mean, she goes, she was so in debt, unless somebody was going to pay her like a half a mil, she had no chance to get out of it. But I don't know, can you even make an employment decision like that?
Well, there's an ethical gray area there. I mean, if it's one thing to say somebody's overqualified, you're not going to hire them. But if you say they're over-leveraged, then you're worried about, are they going to start embezzling or whatever and make ends meet? And I guess that's a real concern if I'm an employer. So,
well, you would hope she'd marry some rich lawyer like you, and then it'd be all over.
Oh, yeah. that's a ticket to nowhere.
But when you look at these numbers, I mean, I'm really happy that this lady wrote this article because it's not about we're trying to make policy here, right? So we get a little here, but here's even better. If you do it by income, a third of the borrowers make less than 50 grand a year. And if you took all the people who make less than 50 grand a year, would cost $437 billion to forgive those people's loans. Wow. If you did everybody under 100,000, would cost the government $938 billion to erase those loans. So if you looked at if you used income as a threshold, if you look for something else, it's really something. So I don't even know how you would sort of go about this. I think one thing for sure is if you got to somehow get this in the bankruptcy piece, Kevin.
Absolutely. I mean, that to me is something that's just been a glaringly unfair way that the bankruptcy code has been written, that these aren't dischargeable. I think if you made it somebody who's in default, who, you know, they're non-performing loans, and the alternative is that, you know, the interest just keeps adding up on it. If you give those people a loophole, I mean, bankruptcy is a solution. It also has a stigma effect, too. If you're, you know, in some kind of wage earner's plan where you have to pay some of this back, but that would be fairer than just wiping the slate clean and still having the problem of how we got in this mess in the first place. So,
well, we've got to have how many people that are absolutely, I'm going to say, disabled, wheelchair ridden, everything else, and these debts are still found. I mean, at some point, you've
got to
say.
Right, some people just, you know, they never got the job that they prepared for. There's no hope of them ever getting it now either. And they've got medical issues, and they've got family burdens, and they've got mortgage foreclosures and everything else added on to that. This is just, you know, they're going into a sinkhole. So there's desperate cases, to be sure. But if you have bankruptcy as an option, there can be a workout, and you make these creditors and the student loans participate in the same way that every other creditor has to. I don't see anything unfair in that. I don't know how this ever got carved out in such a way that these things can't be discharged. That's one of the most grossly unfair things ever.
Well, the I'm sure the attitude was, is that if somebody graduates college or grad school, they don't have a job, they don't have a family yet. Well, I mean, you have a family, hopefully you have parents, brothers and sisters, but you know what I'm saying, you don't have your nuclear family yet. That it would be real easy just for some bankruptcy attorney to say now would be the time. And it'd be, you know, 100 people that the minute you graduate school, you declared bankruptcy, set this loan sailing, and then 2 weeks later, the credit card people call up wanting you to get the new credit card because, what, you can't do it again for 7 years or something. I mean, I'm sure that was the pushback, right?
Probably, yeah.
I mean, you kind of don't have to worry about, you know, somebody who's 55 years old with 3 kids and a house and cars and all the other stuff, kids in school, declaring bankruptcy on a lark. But, you know, could you, if this is the only debt you have, why not? It would be pretty easy. I'm not saying you'd want to, but it would be pretty easy, right?
Well, I guess the thinking, if you were, you know, discharging your MasterCard bill and your Macy's bill or whatever else, as soon as you get your discharge and get your head above water, you're going to start running those bills up again. That's kind of the pattern. But with student loans, you're not going to go back and get another bachelor's degree.
Well, that was... But I mean, you asked what the motivation was to do that, and I'm guessing it's some grumpy old, I'm not going to say what, gray white-haired guy, you know, a gray old white guy would say, hey, look, last thing I want is somebody running up a huge bill at Notre Dame, and his credit card bills and his phone bills, to work a summer as a bartender cashing, and in August declare bankruptcy, and in September start his real job. I'm sure they thought that the laws together would make that too easy. Now, whether they would or they won't, I have no idea. You know, but I would say they probably wouldn't make it all that easy. But I'm sure that was the fear. Would you agree, Matty? I mean, everybody would just do that. You know.
Yeah.
And this is way too easy. We can't be doing that. But now that happens, does that mean that 30 years later, the guy's in a wheelchair and can't even talk, that all of a sudden he can't get rid of it? I don't know that that's something simple like, you know, it's not getting rid of a bankruptcy for 5 years or 10 years or something.
Right, or yeah. The credit with the number of months when the loan was performing, or you were performing on your loan. You know, if there was a good faith effort to pay this thing until there were reverses, and it might have to be addressed on some sort of case-by-case basis, too, which is a boondoggle.
Oh, God.
But I think, you know, I don't know why we treat this so differently from every other kind of debt when it comes to bankruptcy. It's just... Overall, I think we're punishing people for trying to have gotten an education as opposed to going out and buying air fryers or BMWs or something. And those people are forgiven those stupid decisions. But somebody who actually put in the time, got credits, got a degree, got, you know, some sort of professional training, and now can't get a job, I think you have to look at that as no worse a way of spending your time than going out and you know, paying for vacations or other disposable things that didn't get you anywhere and don't really count in your favor as far as your ability to handle money. So I just don't understand the difference in looking at these things.
Well, if you were to do maybe this is more of a Matty Weber question, what percentage of student loans do you think are the people who never got the degree?
I'm sure it's a large percentage.
Oh, it's got to be huge.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a scam too. Really.
Talk about worst case scenario. God, you have the massive amount of debt, especially if you went for, you know, 2-3 years, yet you don't have the piece of paper to show for it, and probably not the job that comes with the piece of paper.
Didn't we send out? Well, I remember his stuff. I can't remember the name of the people, but I'm going to guess he was a African American gentleman who was the former head of the Chicago community college system, and he wrote this paper when he left. He retired. It wasn't like he got fired or anything, and it was about how people should be very careful. And said the only thing, one thing worse than having a 4-year degree with all this debt is having a 3-year no degree and three quarters of the debt.
Yep.
And how you should, if you possibly can, if you can go to a junior college, match up to the engineering at, you know, Illinois, and go to Illinois as your junior year and only have 2 years instead of four, or not go for 2 years, run up a $100,000 bill and say college isn't for me and still have $100,000. I'm sure I don't still have it, but it was a very, very well written paper. But I'm going to say, SP Futures down 10, NASDAQ Futures down 47. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. Do you know when the unofficial start of real estate season is in the Chicago area? It's actually right after the Super Bowl. Yep, it's the time when the guys will finally get off the couch and the families start looking for homes in the area. Now, interest rates also have been hovering around 4%, and the selection of properties are great. And if you're a first-time home buyer, there is an Illinois program that allows you to purchase a home for only 1% down. And that also applies to anyone who hasn't owned a home in the past 3 years. So if you're thinking about it, this is the perfect time. Call or email me, and I will send you a free list of homes designed to your specifications in your area. My phone number is 708-349-3456, or you can email me, AudreyJohnson@Realtor.com. That's AudreyJohnson@Realtor.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, Jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
There's something happening here.
Hello, everyone. Back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tim Ali. Mr. Weber on the board. Mr. Jan Flanagan with us. Are all around mensch. SP Futures down 11, NASDAQ Futures down 53. Did either one of you mavens, happen to read the story about this Tesla? So,
oh, God.
So, here's the, by Laura Kolodny. Boy, I'm actually pretty good on the names here this morning. No one was driving in Tesla crash that killed two men in Spring, Texas. Now, there's a couple questions here that I, not being an engineer on electric cars, the Tesla vehicle crashed into a tree and burst into flames, according to reports. One person was found in the front passenger seat, another in the rear passenger seat. Based on a not funny, they're both dead. Based on a preliminary investigation, police told somebody that they believed nobody had been behind the wheel. Police have not finished their comprehensive investigation. Now, my question is, well, I have several questions here. The Tesla vehicle, 2019 Model S, crashed into a tree and burst into flames, according to the report. One person was found in the front passenger seat and another in the rear, blah, blah, blah. Based on a preliminary investigation, they believe nobody had been behind the wheel. Now, let me get this straight. If you have an electric vehicle, one of the reasons you have one is there's no petrol, read gasoline, correct? Firefighters reportedly used 32,000 gallons of water and spent hours suppressing the fire that resulted from the electric vehicle crash. What the bleep? What is that all about, Jen?
Well, it must be some kind of combustible coating or, you know, engine components or something that will burn pretty furiously.
It's got to be the battery.
Or the upholstery or something.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with that picture.
Yeah, what is, I mean, your car upholstery is not supposed to burn like that, is it?
No, I don't think so.
32,000 gallons of water. Police told the New York Times that minutes before the crash, the wives of the men involved heard them say they wanted to go for a drive and were talking about the vehicle's autopilot feature. The men were 59 and 69 years old, so old enough to know better. What are we doing, Jen? Are we collectively losing our minds or what?
I think so, at a rapid rate.
What, you know, I look at this thing with the student loans, and it's so funny to me that we were talking earlier about the people that want to have like the wealth tax and so forth. God, John, it's the same subject. It's the same thing. We sense something's wrong, and instead of reaching for the most fair across the board solution, we immediately look to see who can benefit that like voted for us or something. And I just can't even. I was beset by right wingers all weekend. And it's astounding to me how, in some of the stuff these people, so of course I was giving them grief about how, me and Audrey and her pals are all right wingers. I said, you know, you guys are just miffed because you weren't invited down to the thing at Mar-a-Lago. You know, the big, now did that officially take over from the one out in the woods in California?
The Bohemian Grove thing or
yeah.
Whatever?
Yeah.
I hope not. There's a sinister outfit.
Yeah, I still remember the picture. Was it Reagan, Tricky Dick, Rumsfeld, Cheney, all those guys all in a row having in their flannel shirts having dinner?
Right.
Nixon looked weird in his flannel shirt. Tricky Dick. They're talking about, well, the Democrats. I said, look, your buddy Todd Ricketts is the finance chair, right? The guy who's the Ricketts, who's the governor of Nebraska.
Oh yeah.
And I said, you know, because they're convinced that the reason why the city's bleeped up is because it's all Democrat. I said, if you think for a second that these people with money care what brand they are, I mean, maybe Ricketts does, but I mean, the people who are, how many people do you think giving money to Lightfoot and Rahm and everybody in the city for their stuff in the city are actually Republican? Why do you have to be Democrat? You're giving money for favors. You're not giving money because you really like the person.
What? Buying influence?
Yeah,
buying. Somebody look the other way or whatever. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you're just. But no matter what you do, you can't ever do anything that's fair. It's got to be something where we can't fix the income tax. We can't make people pay their fair share. If they ever paid their fair share while you were going through, there'd be no reason for a wealth tax, because the person who was wealthy meant that he just made more because he had a better mousetrap. And by the way, he paid as he went along. Why should he have to pay again, right? But nobody believes that. Everybody believes that you managed to buy influence along the way. And it was funny, Jen, I'm looking at, I won't blame you for this, I'll blame Webby. I dug up to my USDebtClock.org, and I remember back in the day, Our buddy Dinkolo the tax guy from the Dink, who's our tax guy in Notre Dame, said that virtually all societies, no matter what you do, you end up with about a little over 25% of the money you get in taxation. Whether it's in Italy where it's 50%, but you get to bribe the tax guy. Or other places where you get to cheat. If you look at the total take, it's usually somewhere between 25 and 30%. And look at our stuff here. I mean, this is scary. I mean, if you look at this debt clock, total federal tax revenue, which is comprised of, just people should probably know these numbers. Income tax, $1.65 trillion. Payroll tax, $1.3 trillion, so almost the same amount. Corporate tax, $214 billion, so like 7% maybe. And everybody's worried about how much these poor corporations make. They don't pay quite squat. And now tariffs, thanks to President Trump, are up to $67 billion. All right? I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying they're up because he was into that. So your total federal tax revenue is $3.4 trillion. Your total state revenue is $2 trillion. Your locals, $1.5 trillion. So you're talking about $7 trillion, okay? And our total GDP is about 22. So what are we talking about? 30%, right?
Yeah.
And yet, there are people that are paying way more than that. There's people paying way less than that. But the total take, now if we could just get to the point where everybody was paying the same ratio, I think it would be a lot fairer for a lot of people, right? I mean, right now, next year, if you made $1 million the last day in California, what is your rate going to be? 63?
If you're lucky, I think.
Yeah, and what does somebody making $20,000 a year pay? If you look at the property taxes, the payroll taxes, and you look at all the fees for your car or for parking, or all that stuff, I gotta believe you're way above 25%. Way above. Right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, so why can't, if Dinkolo is right, and the number is always 25 to 30, and ours is maybe a little higher, if you take all these things together, why can't we just be fair for a change? I mean, nobody, I wouldn't care if Bezos, if he'd have paid his 31% all along the way. I don't care how rich the guy is, but I know he didn't pay it. So it bothers a living bleep out of me, right? So do I like the idea of a wealth tax? Absolutely not. But if you applied it only to him, maybe it's give back, right? Maybe it's give back.
Well, it's a little more targeted and probably more strategic than the alternative minimum tax, which opened the discussion today. It was really good to hear you and Matt talking about that.
Yeah, 155 people the first year.
We got the government to get off its duff to do something about 150 people. Do you think they'd have to work as hard to find it with two violators today that would dwarf all of those losses? So.
Well, there's got to be a list of how many people, I mean, serious guys, talk about Southside, serious guys. I'm going to say, you guys opine, if I were to get the real no good Knicks, the local 12 people, that brought their money overseas and for a period of 2 decades basically didn't pay squat. How many companies are we talking about? 500? 1,000?
Probably, yeah. It's not a huge number.
But the numbers themselves have to be huge.
Oh, yeah.
And why not just say, all right, guys, you haven't paid enough. I mean, come on. You haven't. You're not even close. I mean, I don't know how you do that, but The idea that somebody essentially got to cheat, and don't give me the story about how it was all legal. It was carve outs of some kind from people who either were looking for the IRS guy was looking for a job at your firm or something, right? You can't tell me that. Well, I guess I'm the wrong person to ask, Jambi. I'm gonna accuse you of something here. I don't think there's anything. Is there anything in the legal community, this is going to be a good one. Is there anything in the legal community that is something like the just and equitable principles of trade clause that you'll find in all, we used to be able to find in all the exchanges and stuff? In other words, a smell test.
I don't think so.
I'm going to say
no. I can't quote a chapter and verse. I know that.
Well, because I mean, the whole thing was on the exchange floor. If there was all these, you know, there were rules, but there weren't all that many rules, but there were rules. And the whole idea at the end of the day was, or somehow didn't hold up to the just and equitable principles of trade, sort of like the pornography rule. Wait a minute. If everybody raced with their hand on the broker's behind coming out of the booth and raced into the crowd, if 50 people did that, that would be chaos. So guess what? You can't do it. Even though there specifically was no rule that said you can't walk into the crowd with a broker, right, or with another trader.
Yeah.
But clearly, if you did it for that reason, that stinks. So there was, but I don't know how that works in the rest of society. It worked in one room, you know. I don't know that if you ask lawyers, oh, by the way, you really should stop lying all the time. You know, I don't know if that would work with your group, just saying. But also, you're also based on everybody needs a defense. And even if you think the person's guilty, it's your job to make sure to try and prove them innocent, or at least prove them, mentally handicapped at the time or something.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, everybody gets a defense. I mean, so there's a little bit of a, but you ask yourself, how does this, what are we going to do with this? Now we have some other guy in government and he's totally playing to his people. It was one I sent around last week. You probably got it about how many people who, in the COVID situation, how many contracts with the people who had the biggest lobbyists for the Trump administration?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, duh. I mean, go figure. I mean, that's, it's, I don't know how we, there are times when that's sort of okay, Jan. I mean, I guess the people, if you and I were going to, they went out for a, you know, the trick is to have your lobbyists there early, right? So if you and I were making PT boat engines to go back a ways, we want to have, and we had like a V12 PT boat engine. The trick is to get your lobbyist in there so that the spec was that it had to be a V12. Oh, by the way, we got the only V12. Guess that's us, right? So, I mean, it's not about rigging the bid. It's rigging the bid, the paperwork leading up to the bid, right?
Right.
And you have to have your people there. So it's, but at some point, you would think these guys, even the mob, you know, you would think would let people off of their numbers debt if an asteroid hit the neighborhood for like a week. Government, these people, they're relentless. They're absolutely relentless. But how is it that are things ever going to get bad enough where we hit bottom, where the two sides say, look, we don't agree on this stuff, but we sure agree on most of this stuff. Let's at least do that. I mean, this whole idea of this money flying out there and going to certain people, and how you're paying this person, you're paying even the restaurants. As much as I love to see the restaurants doing better, and obviously I like to go to them, at the end of the day, is somebody going to write a definitive work on who got all the dough, and why is it that the restaurants that were able to play the game ended up making so much friggin' money in the last year that and the rest of the people are closed? Is anybody even going to be able to read, you know, the story, the history of it? I think even...
There would be no way of calculating, you know, the number of bribes or the amount of the bribes or whatever to make all that possible, too. That there was preferential treatment or people looking the other way and getting rewarded in some way for it. That's, you know... But, you know, just to go back to student loans for a minute, I have not seen anything that really carves this out. Maybe you have. But the amount of fraud in the student loan business, I think needs to be...
Jan, maybe help him with it. I never had one. Okay, so... I mean, of course, Notre Dame was $3,200 when we went. So we didn't really need one. Or at least I didn't. Well, let's put it this way. When my dad died at age 4, Social Security had what they used to have, was it the aid to dependent children?
Mm-hmm.
Was one of their deals. Well, it was like $150 a month or something. $200 a month for my brother and me. My mother saved that, and that was our tuition. Which, you know, over a period of, you know, 15 years, they got you your $3,000 a year, right?
Right.
So it wasn't very, it was easy enough to do. I mean, I paid for the rest. I mean, I worked in the summers and stuff. So I didn't even have $50 coming out of their student loan. I didn't even owe my parents $50 because I was able to make enough to where I didn't even have to say, you know, give me $100 for my beer for the month. You know, I didn't have to do that. So I was, we were not rich by any stretch, but I was very, and I think you were probably the same way. I mean, I know you worked for the newspaper and so forth.
Right, and I had student loans because I had a twin brother at the time, so it was an Illinois guaranteed loan, which was backed by the state, but it was funneled through our local bank, my parents' bank, and I signed a note to them, and, you know, the state would have, you know, was in fact insuring the loan so that if I defaulted, the bank would get its money, but I'd still be on the hook to my bank, so. But it worked out fine. It was a very airtight system. I got a check mailed to the university, made out to me, and I would get a card from the bursar's office saying your check is here, and I'd go in, and while I was there, I'd endorse it over to the university. So the university got paid that money. You know, the check was made out to me, but it was going right to Notre Dame. And if I had stopped going to classes the next day and never showed up again, Notre Dame would have still had the money. You know, it wouldn't have made any difference to them. But I could see even in the community college system, there were students all over the place gaming the whole student loan mess.
How do you get up to classes
they had no intention of ever attending, and they were doing this at multiple institutions.
But how did they get the money though? You're just saying how you.
Yeah, that's how it was done. You know, in 1970. For me.
But you signed the check over to Notre Dame. How would you have got any money out of it?
Right, but whatever loan programs it's being gamed, I think have a lot more wiggle room in them that these students actually get the money.
Really?
Yeah.
So in other words, I can go get a $50,000 student loan to go to Purdue, somehow get the money in my Grammy mitt, and not give it to Purdue?
Right.
How the hell does that work?
Well, it shouldn't work, but I think it's working pretty well. Because we had to provide a, you know, in the state system, anybody who was looking for a reimbursement from the state, they had to know a head count for, you know, how many students are actually in this class and actively pursuing, you know, a grade in it. So after like the 10th day, starting after a semester, you'd give a head count and students you'd never seen, they had no idea who they were. You'd have to record them on a separate sheet and identify them. And I remember talking to a couple of people in the business office about it, and they said, well, there's tremendous fraud with these students. You know, they've got multiple identities, they're going around and signing up for classes, and they're juggling the money, and they may get caught in a couple places, but they won't get caught at all of them. And I was just flabbergasted, and I could never get them to really disclose how this worked. But that's just one part of the fraud where you got crooked borrowers. But there's crooked lenders, too, and crooked colleges and unaccredited institutions that have driven up the cost of everybody's borrowing money. And I'd like to see some way of accounting for how bad behavior throughout the system has gotten.
Are there kickbacks in the system? I mean, where you were... So I find this incredible. How did we forget how to do this? We knew how to do it 50 years ago.
I mean, it became profitable for some people to forget.
But there's a logic. I mean, if somebody... If you were to take your, and a lot of people have done this, obviously that's a lot of our business. If somebody has a 401k or something, and they want to, say they retire or whatever, and they want to take the money out of 401k and bring it to an IRA at PTI or elsewhere, they give you a check made out to both PTI and you.
Requiring both endorsements.
Yeah. So how do...
I would think, you know, that seems like a very easy, you know, and there's at least ways of making sure that the crooks can't just waltz in or waltz out. So it puts an obstacle in the way where you got another plan. If you're really interested in committing fraud, of course, there's ways you can do that, too, with fake identities and everything else.
But all it takes is somebody with an ounce of brains at the 401k place to see that check went into Jan Flanagan's account in Switzerland and say, well, that's not where we intended. It's supposed to go to PTI. Is account of PTI, right? I mean, if we don't catch it, they should be able to.
You would think. I mean, that seems like a very easy safeguard to build into this. My experience, though, and I was never a financial aid counselor or anything like that. I had friends at my institution who would tell me the horror stories of, you know, the fraudsters they had run up against. But I suspect the problem isn't just confined to those people who were borrowing money for no purpose connected to education whatsoever, but it's institutions that have been set up just to accept this money, and they have nothing to do with education, period.
Well, is there everybody else?
They got gullible students who they can play into and get them into unaccredited programs or string them along or put up roadblocks along the way to keep them enrolled and dangle stuff in front of them. And all the while, the student loan industry is chugging away, fueling this. I don't know anybody who's really been interested enough to get a total for what kind of numbers we're talking about, but I would suspect it's a lot larger than anybody would dream.
Well, are there any institutional, I use the term kickbacks, to where if I want, I hope Notre Dame wouldn't do this, but you never know with money involved. Where if it's 70 grand, I go get a loan for 70, I bring them the check, and they say, "Well, we're gonna give you a scholarship for 20. How about we'll each take 10 of the 70?" I mean, nobody's accused anybody of that, have they?
No, but I bet in some institutions that isn't unusual. Where you got, you know, a crossover with money or defraying of expenses with a so-called scholarship or whatever. It's so supposedly funded by the institution you're attending. And I'm not accusing any institutions as a group or in large numbers of doing this, but I have felt for a long time that the system is so badly run and monitored that it would be not very difficult to pull major scams. And especially if you were using a segment of the population of students who are hungry to get something to get them out of where they are. And this would, you know, selling them a certificate program that's going to give them XYZ, and it only takes this long.
Well, Jan, what are they?
There's scams all over the place for that stuff.
They're all allegedly broke, right? I mean, the universities, or they're not, you know, I mean, they're not making a fortune, but there's massive amounts of cash there. I mean, I was talking to, Audrey and her friends, the real estate people, we only got a few minutes, but let's talk about it, because we start talking about where does the money come from, and you've done a lot of real estate work. How quickly, I mean, you need a Federal Reserve, no matter whatever it is, whether it's here or Europe or someplace, you need money in the system for this to happen, because if the houses are all going for 200 grand, and all of a sudden one goes for like 230, and it gets appraised there, I mean, clearly the bank has to come up with another 30 grand in the mortgage, right?
Right.
Well, they got to get it from somewhere. I mean, the liquidity has to be available. But how quickly have you seen, when you've done the closings and stuff that you've done, how quickly can that number move up? What does it take? Does it take a guy like Matty Weber with nothing but money that says, "Hey, look, I'm paying 230. Here's the other 30 cash. You know, shut your pie hole." And all of a sudden, that's a 230, and somebody else pays 225, and now all the houses are allegedly worth 230. I mean, how quickly can that ramp up?
Well, I think Audrey was saying last week that it's within hours or a day, and I suspect that's certainly the case. Now, it wasn't the case 40 years ago, or almost 50 years ago now that I started in the real estate business. It took a long time for that stuff to percolate out among brokers and certainly among the public. You know, the Cook County Recorder was like 6 weeks behind in posting transfer, so you didn't know what a house sold for if you're waiting around for the county building to publish exactly what the transfer tax paid on that transaction was. So there was a huge delay factor, but it was a very different lending market then too, because the appraisals were pretty much drive-by your savings and loan, you know, janitor or employee or somebody who knew the neighborhood, knew the whole history of the neighborhood, knew the history of this particular house, and the appraisals were, you know, everybody kind of knew, kind of almost instinctively, what this house was worth. Now, I mean, when there's a sale, it's in the system within a day. And, you know, if you can get into the MLS, and you don't even have to be a broker to do this, I can find out what stuff in my neighborhood sold for usually about 48 hours after it happens, just by Googling the address.
Well, back in the early 80s, in the original condo craze, I know I'm dating myself here, Robin and I, we remodeled a few places together, and she's a great partner. But we went to some place. Remember where the old Belden Deli was?
Oh, yeah.
It was right across the street. There was an 8-flat, 12-flat or something. So we're in there looking at these apartments, and they were all, I mean, they were not where you'd want to move in, but they had space, and they were in a nice spot, and So, you know, and they were X number of square foot. And all of a sudden, one of the ladies says, well, everybody can go home. What do you mean? We can all go home? We haven't even looked at them all yet. Well, we just called it a board of trade, and 10 guys just each bought a unit. Right? Just sight unseen. Because they did, saw the square footage, they knew the block, they just bought them. So it was all cash, and it was, I guess you don't even really need a... Every one of the guys resold it before it closed. They sold their place in line for a profit. That's how quick it was moving up.
Kind of redefined flipping.
Well, but this is when... Well, you know what? People talk about flipping, and you get on TV, and... by the way, I still think, after watching all these shows, everybody says I was an idiot, which I am on a lot of subjects, but my buddy Scott Benjaminson, the actor, Matt Weber poo-pooed this, everybody else I ever talked to, I guarantee you we have Chicago PD, we got Chicago Fire, we got Chicago Med, we could have had Chicago Kung Fu Women Rehabbers. And if they were good-looking enough, like the girls on Charlie's Angels, and they were flipping houses in Chicago, that show would be a huge hit.
Absolutely.
I'm just saying.
People love those flipping shows.
Combine it with Baywatch, and you know, have lakefront or riverfront properties thrown in, too.
And a couple guys come in, and try and steal a 2x4, and they give them some kung fu. It's all over. I mean, it would be... But
Tom, you missed your calling. You should have been pitching these shows.
But the thing of it is, back in those days, Jan, we were coming off of really 15% mortgages. So,
right.
So the prices were going up so fast on these houses. Wait a minute, my mortgage is going to be 10% instead of 15? I can afford that. I mean, the prices were up. I mean, you could buy a condo for what, 20 grand? And 6 months later, they were 40, right?
Right. And when I was working at Chicago Title, they were selling so fast, and there's so many of them, that they had 24-hour closings. We had closings in the Chicago Title office going 24 hours a day.
Well, what's going on downtown? I don't want to lob the name out there because I don't like the people. The people who decided to buy back Lake Point Tower from all the people who owned it and make it rental.
Deconvert it,
2 years ago. How happy do you think they are with what's going on downtown? God, that has to be the worst trade ever.
I guess I wouldn't have seen anything like this down the pike either. So maybe they're no dumber than I am, but I agree. I mean, this is something that you know, they must be kicking themselves. Let somebody else put the bill for this. Why are we sitting on all these apartments we can't do anything with now?
Well, all right, John, thank you very much. But SP Futures down 11, NASDAQ Futures down 63. Come back. Let Mr. Mike Hart talk about volatility, talk about the markets.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox. The control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed-income securities, and are now unhappy with their choice. At PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Holley, Mr. Matt Weber on the board. So, Matty, you still have no opinion as to how it took 32,000 gallons of water to put out a Tesla car fire.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
There's supposed to be no gas there, right?
Right. Doesn't mean there's no fire.
Well, but I mean, your stuff inside, your upholstery and stuff is supposed to be somewhat fire retardant. And is that the battery burn it? It's got to be.
That's the only thing I can think of, yeah.
That's scary. Anyway, S&P futures down 10, Nasdaq futures down 61, Dow futures down 68. Over in Europe, we've got slow all around the world here. DAX down 18.1%, FTSE down 8.1%, CAC around up 22.3%. Over in Asia, Nikkei up 2, let's call that flat. Shanghai up 50, just a movement there, 1.5%. Hang Seng up 136.5%. The Indian markets are way down. We don't really have those here, maybe Mike does. COVID infections are big in India. India and Brazil seem to be the spots for the COVID infections now. Brazil is actually kind of troubling. Bonds up one basis point to 1.59. The bond up 3 basis points. Minus 0.22. These guys are actually making a move towards zero here. They're going from 0.37 negative to 0.22 really in the last 5 or 6 days. Japan is up 0.085. Oil, unchanged at 63.13. Brent down a penny, 66.76. Natural gas up 3 cents, 271. RBOB unchanged at 203. And we've got gold down $3 at 17.77, but still hit a 7-week high. Silver down 19 cents, 25.91. Copper up 8 cents, 425. And crypto, we asked Mike about this in a second. I've got it up $1,100 to 56,921, but they're actually down like 5,000 one of the days this week. And we're going to ask Mike where the hell that actually trades. Maybe we got for us traffic, weather, sports.
36 minutes past the hour. Good morning once again to everyone out there. That earlier crash on the outbound Ford at 159th is all clear, but now we have a new one that appears to be even worse. Outbound Bishop Ford at 130th Street, there's a crash that's now blocking the two left lanes. Fire is on the scene, not looking good, and that's causing all kinds of issues on the outbound of Bishop Ford. So keep that in mind if you're heading out in that direction on the south side. No issues on the Ryan at this hour. Normal traffic volumes there. Same for I-57. Traffic building heavily on the Stevenson and Eisenhower, but no accidents to report. Same could be said for the Kennedy. Eden's still looking good. Lakeshore Drive's quiet in both directions. Off the expressways, we have a couple of issues in the western suburbs. Lake Street on the westbound side at Swift Road, there is a crash. And then just north of there, Route 53 on the northbound side before Kirchhoff Road, there's an accident blocking the right lane. And then out in Elgin, there's traffic lights not working that are causing delays at Big Timber Lane Road and Illinois 31. Everything else is all quiet out there. Weather today, it's going to be cloudy and temperatures dropping this evening. We could have some rain showers this afternoon as well, a high of 50, which is kind of where we were at earlier this morning, because right now it's mostly cloudy and 49, so we're kind of hovering around our high right now, and then temperatures will drop later on. Going to be absolutely miserable tomorrow with a chance to break the all-time record low tomorrow. We'll see what that looks like. Right now it is cloudy and 49 with rain later on. For our Phoenix listeners, sunshine with a high of 88 today. Right now it's clear and 62. In sports, the White Sox swept a doubleheader in Boston yesterday, winning 3-2 in Game 1 and 5-1 in Game 2. They'll play in the Patriots Day morning game later on this morning. It's a 10:10 a.m. Chicago time first pitch in Boston. Of course, there's no marathon in Boston because that's been pushed back to October, as we talked about earlier. Cubs were blown out yesterday, or last night, I should say, at Wrigley, falling to the Braves 13-4. They dropped 2 of 3 in that series and have a much-needed off day today. Diamondbacks beat the Nats 5-2. Chief.
You think they need the rest or what?
I think they just need to figure it out, which may never happen. They just don't look like a good team to me.
No, they sure don't. Mike, how are you?
Hey, doing fantastic, Chief. How you doing?
Doing all right. Hey, could you educate us on this Bitcoin? Do they obviously trade on the weekends, but they have a closing price on the... I mean, it's not like... What I'm saying is if the S&Ps, for whatever reason, trade on a day off,
right,
the next day they carry the price from the last official trading day. But the Bitcoin was down $5,000 someplace this weekend. So today, even though it's 4,000 from Friday night's down, it's showing up 1,000 today. Where does that trading get marked on a Saturday, Sunday?
See, I think it depends on what platform you're using, possibly. I would say, if you ask me, I would have thought the market gets marked to market on Friday. You have the trade throughout the weekend, and then the price that we'd be looking at today would be the price from Friday. My platform, I use the Tastyworks platform, shows it down 5,000. So it must just be which platforms we're looking at.
Okay, because the CNBC's got them up one to where they're down 5 from Friday. So,
right, yeah, they are definitely down. And, you know, one interesting thing about this move is this morning, it's quite a move for Bitcoin that we've seen recently to the downside. And Bitcoin's really gone up in volume. There's a lot more players in the game. So it's rare to see a gappy type market where it gaps a lot. I would say 2 years ago, Bitcoin gapped quite a bit, meaning the change from the previous day would often not be a continuous line, but rather a line where it would break and be open much lower or open much higher. Today's an actual gap, and I don't see what happening going back all the way to December of last year.
Was there a specific, say, on the Tasty Trade platform, is the opening on Saturday at 8 o'clock where it opens up down 5 grand, or is it a continual thing all through the night and through elsewhere?
I think on the Tastyworks it's going to open down 5,000. And then we'll probably trade from there today. That would be my guess. And then it gets marked to market every day, just like a future.
Okay, so there is a, whatever platform we're using, there is an opening time.
Absolutely. Okay. I don't know the specifics for Bitcoin, because the beautiful thing about the futures market is they manage to always adjust times for different products that you trade. So you really need to specialize in that product to know the specific times.
Okay, well, that's good, interesting stuff there. It's because I could have sworn I was reading about how it was down all weekend. I came in today and, wait a minute, the thing's up 1,000, but it's still down. So a little confusing.
Yeah, don't be fooled by the number.
Don't be fooled by these numbers. what do you make of market? Seems to be on a day to day basis is slowing down. In terms of intraday moves, I don't know that that's causing people to think that the interday moves are going to be any less going forward, but at least the intrust stuff is going down, which means kind of less trade during the day. I don't know if that's good or not.
Well, what it does cause is a term that we'll put towards a market like this, which is complacency among traders. And complacency is a lack of fear of risk, because risk, as the market moves higher, there's an inverse relationship with volatility, meaning that when market moves to the upside, and especially when it moves slowly to the upside like we're seeing now, we'll see volatility really start to decline. And that we will call complacency, meaning there is less fear in the market. Hey, think about it. Volatility is declining, and that's the fear gauge. When volatility is really high, there's a lot of fear on the street. Volatility is low, there's not much fear. So right now, with this type of market move, I mean, I think in the past 2 weeks, we've been down a couple days, but for the most part, we're grinding higher, even if it's just a little bit every day. This is a volatility killer.
Well, it definitely is. I mean, we've lost, well, in one man's opinion, we don't even look at, I mean, the technical analysts are running the show. I mean, we're looking at, we've got some spectacular looking charts on stuff that is, you know, probably 10 times, in one man's opinion, where some stuff should be trading. And we've even reached to the point where stuff that is worth kind of nothing, you know, I won't say, well, I guess I'll lob it out there. Like, a Bitcoin has no basic. I mean, what's, you weren't on, did you read the thing? I have to get your email for my stuff I send out on the weekends. The guy with the $100 million valuation on the one delicatessen that wasn't even open last year? Did you see that?
I read the headline, but I did read the headline, and I was shocked by the number, but I didn't read the entire article. Was there any major points?
Well, I mean, it's just the stock's trading $13. There's big investors out of one of the provinces in China. It's over the counter. It never goes down. It doesn't trade much, but it never goes down. So it's, if you could get out, and the guy who runs the place, the wrestling coach who was the alleged owner, has options for like another 7 million shares at $2 a share. So some ridiculous number.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I guess it isn't much of a walk really from a stock that is trading 100 times revenue to a stock that doesn't even have anything. What's the difference? I mean, we're talking about,
right?
You know, I mean, okay, this stock is backed up by a lemonade stand. This one doesn't have anything. What's the difference?
Well, you know what they say, and this might go back to Greenspan, but the market can stay irrational longer than maybe you can stay solvent.
Oh, God, yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, we have seen irrationality in the market in the past, and this sounds to me like a very irrational type of market move that you could definitely bet against, but, you know, the question is, can you hold out long enough until the market comes to some normalcy, which there's a high expectation that markets eventually do find normalcy and return to the mean, and don't stay counterintuitive forever. But we just don't know when that will stop. That's the biggest risk.
Well, the progress, and I can't believe I did this, Mike. I don't know if you heard it or not, but I did a historical piece on the tulip fiasco. And it's,
I saw that. Yep. Cool.
But it's pretty scary that it's legitimized by becoming mainstream, being on exchanges or firms doing it, and then all of a sudden you reach the point where you can margin it, and it's usually not that far after it becomes marginable that the problems occur. And like even the Bitcoin, that's what we're doing now. How far away are we from, or is it marginable now someplace?
I don't know about the margin regulations. Everything's coming on slowly. It will be marginalized, and you will see the power of leverage when that happens. And the power of leverage is, it tends to be like a magnifying glass that can magnify returns, magnify losses. So when you're talking about margin, you're right. That's when problems might occur, and you will see sort of typical market movement where a large down move like today may cause, you know, maybe the the cause of a larger down move because of margin calls, things like that.
Well, right now, is there anybody that's, if I wanted to buy some Bitcoin today, I wanted to buy two Bitcoins, but I only want to pay for one. I want to buy 200 shares of IBM, and I only want to pay for 100. That I can do at PTI, Tasty Trade, anywhere you want, right? Because the Fed sets those rates. Is that possible for me to do in Bitcoin right now, anywhere? I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer.
I don't know. I actually don't think any brokerage legitimate brokerage that I know of is offering that, because on the brokerage level, they have risk that they implement as well, you know, risk controls. And whatever the volatility of Bitcoin is, we don't have the same calculation quite yet for Bitcoin. I at least don't have the volatility for it. So whatever the volatility is, it's high enough in the crypto market that the most stable of the coins, which is Bitcoin, the largest traded coin in the market, you probably can't get any margins on it from any brokerage that I know.
Well, there's no way the broker can take that to the bank and bifurcate it. There's no way you're going to get money from that, right? I mean, if we don't do it at PTI, but our clearing firm does. Somebody wanted to buy 1,000 shares of IBM and only pay for 500. What'll happen is the RBC or IB can take that money to the bank and borrow the other 500, right? And it's good capital.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a way of risk reduction on the risk management end of the brokerage. You know, Bitcoin, you could do the same with Bitcoin to, you know, leverage out the risk or to manage out the risk. But I don't know how the risk is managed on Bitcoin. I got to be honest. I think some places, and this could be for most of the industry, it might just be a buy only for a lot of these cryptos. Still, a buy only market.
I think
most retail traders can buy, but they can't. They can't get short, which, of course, you know, to have a fully functioning market, you need both sides of the equation.
Yeah, I would say. What we talked really a couple times now, when you see the VIX is, well, the VIX is actually up today, but I'm still not convinced on this calculation on this VIX, Mike, that the screw around between Friday and Monday, I don't think the calculation handles the weekend very well. I never have. Am I wrong, or, I mean, am I just being grumpy?
Well, the calculation's right, but that being said, there is this weekend effect that it occurs in the market. Everyone knows about it, so it's a known that over the weekend there's 2 days lost. And as far as volatility on the VIX level goes, it's just going to reflect what happened that weekend, and it's not unusual to see a move that doesn't quite make sense on Monday compared if you're just looking at market moves, because the VIX is all-encompassing, we like to say, where it captures the risk of everything that might be affecting the market, and it might be taking on what you might refer to as the weekend risk, or risk that was added or taken away from just the occurrence of events over the weekend. So right now the market's down, so it's not surprising to see the VIX up a little bit.
Yeah, I just don't. I'm not sure it should have been down, you know, 0.9 of a point on Friday and back up today. I think we're right about where we were Friday night. I'm just saying, but the.
We're seeing small moves in the VIX, yeah, just like the market. Market and VIX are intertwined. They're inversely related at a very high correlation level. And that relationship tends to hold up. But we've been seeing very small movement in the VIX, and it's mostly been to the downside. So VIX is trading right now at 17, 14. So 17, that's low. That's the lowest we've been in a year, or more than a year. And historically, it's relatively high, but I got to be honest, when we do the math now, the historical average has moved up because of last year.
Right.
And that's the interesting about market research is it's dynamic, it changes. So prior to 2020, we would have said the average VIX level is about 15.5. Now that average is actually closer to 18, so you could say the 20-year average, we're at 17, we're below the 20-year average.
Well, I'm going to say that, that after 2008, it's, I use the term normal, that the VIX going out in the calendar either stays the same or goes up, or before that it went down. A little bit.
I haven't run that study, so I don't know how the VIX operated prior to 2008, but that's an interesting observation, and I would totally believe it.
Because then the million-dollar question comes down, and you and I are always, we're not arguing about or debating. It's, in my memory, in my history, it seems like your biggest moves are when the VIX is complacent. In other words, you would say, I think, in that because it's down to, say, 17 versus 22, where it was forever, that the chances of us dancing around today up and down and all over the place and having a 1% or 1.5% move like every day like we're having for a while are getting less and less. I would agree with you 100%. But I would also say that it seems like the risk of the 5% move actually gets higher when the VIX gets lower and lower and lower and people get complacent.
Yes, and we've seen that before. We just got off a decade of low volatility, really low volatility. But what's interesting about volatility is volatility doesn't go to zero when you're talking about the market. There's always a little bit of risk that is associated with market movement. It's about 9% or the VIX has sort of a hard stop around 9. As low as volatility gets, we don't go much below 9. So we can hang out at 9, go to 10, even 11, but we'll trade in that range, and we did that for years. And with 2020 really caught people off guard because the move was dramatic, it was fast, it was a huge move to the upside, and a lot of people got caught playing that short volatility game, which has worked for so long it changed the game for a lot of people.
Well, even the people that, the guys that got caught with some of the stuff were guys like me that did some covered rights for people at what we thought were, you know, pretty good prices, and all of a sudden the things are buried. I mean, I do some work for people where guys call me up and say, "Chief, you got to help me do this roll," and the stock will be like 230, they go, "Which one's your short?" Well, like the 140s. Okay. that's going to be a tough roll. I don't know where we're going to roll that one into the gutter, maybe. But but I mean, so many stocks have been like that. I mean, right?
You're absolutely right. And especially when you look back to March of last year when the market really took a tumble. What's so fascinating about the move is how quickly we recovered. We were only down there for, call it, 2 months before we really saw a rebound. And a very short period of time, when you compare it to 2008, where it took a couple of years for the market to really recover fully, it took only a couple months for the market to recover from the massive loss that we, you could argue it was a more of a shock than 2008 in 2020, but it was a massive move that quickly reversed.
Well, in 2008, I could go back. Actually, I'm doing my, I'm going to send you some info when I finish this, but I'm ways away from it. Going all the way back to 1960, and I'm doing a money supply per year, CPI per year, stock per year, and a couple other things, all in the same Excel sheet. So we'll be able to compare.
Okay.
And it's pretty fascinating, but I'm going to say that the recovery in the market versus last year versus 2008. 2008, we were unprecedented 8.5% money supply growth for years after 2007, 2008. And we came back at a, and now this year we were 25%. So it's not surprising to me that we went up an awful lot faster. I mean, just look at these, some of these other places.
Right.
I mean, the Fed basically printed money and bought stuff and drove all the prices up.
And that was the feeling. I would love for you to send me that. That sounds really, really interesting. And that's an interesting number to focus on, because I think sort of behind the curtain, that is what is going on. The question is, what are the repercussions of this type of reaction to a market move?
I have a hunch they're there to be determined. We might still get that arrow in the behind. Let's hope not. SP Futures down 8 and NASDAQ Futures down 65. I'm Tom Allies, Mr. Mike Hart. Thank you, Mike. Mr. Matt Weber, who's tomorrow, you or Jeff?
Tomorrow should be Jeff.
Okay. We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
Hey, guys. What's up, G? Want to go to Tchotchke's? Get some coffee?
Oh, it's a little early.
I got to get out of here. I think I'm going to lose it.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.